Welcome to the AquariMax audio show with Russ and Kelly. We provide information on all kinds of aquarium-related topics.
This is episode 127, recorded August 20th, 2012.
Greetings all.
Hello.
From the world of AquariMax.
Yes, welcome again to our fishy existence.
That was quite the intro there, thank you.
Yeah, that was weird, huh? Okay. We are going to give you some more beta updates today, and we are going to get to Tony's questions and comments on Algae Cruise, Tony in New York, that we were not able to do justice to last time.
Right. So we just barely mentioned it, now we're going to dig in and get to the nitty-gritty.
Yes, oh, that was another quote, Andreika. You can tell us if you know what it's from. Oh, I offered points to somebody for if they knew something last time, and now I don't remember what I said, but nobody came up with it, so...
So it's okay.
It's okay. So, what are the betas doing?
Well, this is kind of neat. They are beginning to assume a body shape that is more beta-like rather than just generically fry-like. In terms of their finnage, they're developing the long anal fin that betas are recognizable for. Meaning long is in that it covers a large area of the surface, the ventral surface of their body. They're not really long in the sense of long and flowing yet. I noticed an interesting thing about the eye type. Their mother has just pure black eyes. Pupil, the iris, the whole thing is just black. Their father, very nearly so, but not quite. And some of the babies have very black eyes all the way around, and the other ones, some of them have... lighter irises, so it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
They're all the same.
Right. And it seems to be, in my experience, I've noticed that some of the Cambodias tend to have the darker eyes like that, and they have a very light body, and they have reddish fins, and then they have the black eyes. And I know that many of them do not have that, but when I've seen it, I seem to have seen it more often on the Cambodias. So, interesting.
Remind me what the Cambodia is again.
Basically, it means a light body with darker fins.
Okay.
And so, once again, their body shape is beginning to assume that more like the betta. And the bettas that are larger tend to be more and more like that, where the younger bettas, many of them don't have that shape yet. Still, they still have the undifferentiated fry shape, but most of them are larger and have the more betta shape. Now, they've also begun to show some coloration, haven't they?
They have, just a little bit. If you look really close, you can see just a little bit of blue iridescence.
Yeah, on some of the finnage.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which, you know, does vary quite a bit depending on beta color variety, but since ours have, both parents have whitish bodies, that it's probably, you'd notice less color with ours than you would with some other strains. And finally, one thing we have noticed...
They're being rather precocious in this area, actually.
Yeah, some of them are starting to demonstrate a bit of aggression.
Already?
Not a whole lot. I mean, they're not going after each other's fins or anything, but they'll do the kind of face-off, get out of my way, and the other one will dart away, or they'll even peck at each other just a little bit. So we're going to have to jar them really soon.
Much sooner than we meant to.
Right.
Speaking of jars...
Oh, yeah. This was really cool.
We got a very lovely surprise in the mail.
We did. And because we haven't actually asked if we can do this, we're not going to mention who did it. But
so we don't want to embarrass them. Because we know they didn't send them just so that we would tell everybody that they sent them, but
it was just
because they're cool.
It was a nice and useful and helpful thing to do. So thank you to the Aquarimaxer, who for now shall remain nameless, who sent us 3 half-gallon, or approximately half-gallon, beta jars in the mail.
Which was very nice. They'd shipped them themselves, and
yeah, and
we didn't know that they were coming. It was just a lovely surprise in the mail. I went, oh my goodness, look at this!
It was, and there was a funny joke on it too, because the carton or the box that they were sent in on the outside had printed something like, "For a better environment, this container has not been bleached." And,
blah blah blah.
It was
blah,
made
blah.
Of recyclable materials or something like that. And this mystery Aquarimaxer had scratched out the ER and put a big A, so it said, "For a better environment."
It was pretty cool.
I loved that. That was funny. So, thank you to our mystery Aquarimaxer for sending those jars. And they will be very useful as we begin to jar our little pugnacious piscine pals.
Oh, that was pretty good.
I just came up with that just now.
That's pretty good.
Okay. All right. So what are we doing next? What did Tony want us to talk about today?
Well, he wants to know about algae cleanup crews for his 6.6 gallon, yes?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah, he's got the 6.6 gallon at work, and it's got some hair algae going on.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were going to talk about that, weren't we?
So was he asking? He was asking you what would be best for his situation.
He says yes. He wants to have a bit of discussion on options for cleanup crews, plus pros and cons for each, ideal tank conditions and tank mates to avoid. And he's trying to get an option for this 6.6 office gallon aquarium, which is already fish recycling. There's a lot of hair algae in there. Temperature's in the low 70s, but he is open to getting a heater if need be. So, we're going to look at this kind of fairly specifically in terms of Tony's tank, 6.6
okay.
gallons, but, you know, some of this, a lot of this could apply to other tanks too, and we'll discuss, you know, different possibilities as well to some extent. But I would like to throw out my caveats first, which I always do when we're talking about algae. And that first one is that, of course, this is for all of you, not specifically for Tony. I know you know this, Tony, but there are some beginners out here who may not know about this. Algae crews only control algae if you've got feeding under control and water changes are a regular part of the regimen. Partial water changes, but, you know, frequent and fairly significant water changes, and that your photo period is within the proper range. So it won't do a whole lot of good if to put an algae crew in a tank if you're leaving your lights on 24 hours a day, or even, you know, 18 or whatever, or if you're feeding too much, or if you're just not doing enough water changes. Algae can go nuts. I mean, algae is crazy stuff. And also physical removal is sometimes important. Just algae in large quantities, especially ones that get long strings and filaments and threads that are stick together, especially if they're thick, when they get to that point, if you're not removing it, the algae on the outside can start using the dead algae on the inside for nutrients. So you can have, you know, pristine water conditions as far as that goes, changing the water and getting all the nutrients out, but the algae can start living on that dead algae inside there and keep growing for a long time. So those are some things to think about in general when you're thinking about algae. Algae crews are good, yes. In my experience, they help a lot, but only if these other things are, you know, under control. So there we go. Now let's hit our first one. Our first species we're going to talk about is
baby bristle noses.
Yeah.
Now, or just bristle noses.
Right. But if you're thinking in terms of algae control in general, bristlenose plecos, mm-hmm. and sister species are great. And if you're thinking about a 6.6 gallon tank, I would only consider a baby one.
What
in
do you
there.
Fit when it's grown up?
See, that's one of the cons.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
I'm jumping again.
No, that's okay.
Okay, well, tell us about the baby bristlenoses then.
Okay, well, let's start with the pros of baby bristlenose plecos or ancestris or, you know, bushy-nose plecos are also called. One is that they stay small for quite a while. They take a long time to grow up. So if you have a small one, and you can usually get them fairly small at the store, you can plan on keeping it in the tank for a good while before it gets too big. But it will eventually get too big, but, you know, stay small for a while. Some people tend to report that the albinos stay small longer.
Oh.
And the females don't get as big as the males. So those are some things to think about.
So you could get an albino female baby.
Yeah, and maybe it would take a good while before you'd have to move it. Maybe even a couple of years.
Hmm.
They're good at several types of algae. I mean, they'll eat quite a few different types of algae. They're not so much into the hairy or fluffy sorts of algae that grow on the tips of leaves. They're more, they'll scrape it off of surfaces like driftwood, rocks, glass, and big leaves like leaves of Anubias. Things like
audibly.
That.
Even.
Yeah, if it's off driftwood,
it's
you
funny.
Can hear it if it's very quiet and otherwise quiet in a room.
We hear it in our room at night if we're going to sleep and, you know, the rest of the house is asleep and all of a sudden there's this scritch, 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 scritch. And I have to remind myself, it's just the fish. It's okay.
Yeah. Scratching away at the
nothing
driftwood.
Nothing is coming for me in the night.
Right. And if you hear that scratching noise out there, that's the cat in the hallway playing. So hopefully you don't hear that too much. Sorry about that. But those are a couple of pros. A couple of cons that, well, I should say there's a few more pros, actually. They're easy to obtain, and, well, I actually mentioned that they're already slow growing, so I don't have to go into that. And those are probably most of the pros that we'll cover for now. There are others. The cons, they're not so good at hair algae, which I guess I sort of alluded to already. They will eventually outgrow a 6.6-gallon tank and will need to be rehomed. I recommend for females at least a 10-gallon and better a 20, and for males at least a 20, although some people keep them in 10-gallon tanks with no problems.
Could you probably sell them back to the pet store?
Often, yeah, I have. I've sold dozens of them, you know. They are not too difficult to unload. They will add significantly to bioload. All Placos are, pretty messy. Even bristlenoses, they're not quite on the par with big old, you know, Trinidad Placos, but they still make a bit of a mess. And the tank conditions that they require, they're not really particular in terms of temperature, in terms of water, alkalinity and things like that. The hardness, they don't really care very much. So low 70s are okay. You can even keep them in an unheated tank, which is a plus, as long as your tank doesn't get too cold. But low 70s is perfectly fine.
What's their upper range?
And they do well in warmer waters. You know, I wouldn't want to keep them above 86. That's, pushing it. But low 80s is certainly perfectly fine for them.
Okay.
And one thing to remember is that they need a lot of food in addition to algae. Algae is just not going to cut it for them. Especially since if it's the type of algae they like, they'll probably take care of almost all of it pretty fast. And then you'll need to supplement their diet heavily with things like algae chips, zucchini, split green beans, preferably
peas.
Canned. Yeah, peas that have been removed from their skins, that sort of thing. And they will eat those readily, and they require food like that to be healthy on a regular basis.
Algae is not enough.
Algae is not enough.
So what are good tank mates for the bristlenose?
Well, they're pretty tough in terms of being able to defend themselves, mm-hmm. because they're pretty well-armored.
They are. They look kind of like little tanks.
Right. They've got...
bottom of the tank.
Not only do they have bristly faces, the males have bristly faces, and some of the females even do to a lesser extent, but they've got spicules and armor of all kinds of things, little... like hairs that cover... especially the males, the pectoral fins, and their whole body has these plates all over it. And when they get upset, they can extrude these structures called odontodes from the sides of their head, mm-hmm. which are, that term odontodes is Greek for "do you want a piece of me?" Just kidding, had to throw a little Piscean humor in there, but they're kind of like maces,
wow.
the medieval weapon, uh-huh. a mace, where it has this a stick with a spike, with a big ball attached to it, and then spikes sticking out of it. That's what these little structures are like. And not only are they spiky, but they have hooks on the end of the spikes.
Just to get stuck.
So something trying to swallow those finds it a very difficult task indeed to manage. And not just that, but they'll flip their heads around when they get upset at other fish.
Trying to stab them with these spikes.
Right, and with their tails, they'll slap at them and stuff. So they can defend themselves pretty well. So they can do well with somewhat aggressive other fish. But they'll also, since their mouths are not really equipped for it, they won't eat things like baby guppies.
They're not particularly aggressive themselves.
Right, so as long as the tiny fish is free swimming, they really won't go after it to try to eat it. If they're larger fish and they're starving, they have been known, if they are not presented with other food, to go after things like goldfish and scrape at their skin, their slime, their body slime, when they're really hungry. But as long as they're well fed, they're not too bad with other fish. They will get in scraps with other fish over food, and they'll kind of try to push the other fish away. But
okay.
Just the short of this is they're really pretty good with a lot of other fish, as long as, they're well fed.
And it sounds like water temperature-wise, there's kind of a range that you could keep them.
Definitely. They're quite adaptable.
Okay.
Anywhere from very low 70s to mid-80s is fine temperature-wise. And in terms of, I already mentioned, in terms of alkalinity and acidity and hardness, they're pretty adaptable as well.
Okay. Well, before we go on to our next species, let's take our break.
Hello, this is Ken Jones of the Prince of Ponds and Pet Tech Podcasts, and you're listening to one of my favorites, the Aquarimax Show.
Now there are more ways than ever to be a part of Aquarimax. In addition to downloading the podcast on iTunes, you can follow us on Twitter, like our Facebook page, subscribe to our YouTube channel, or call us anytime and leave a phone message at 801-477-0629, or just email us at info@aquarimax.com. And now, back to the Aquarimax Audio Show, the podcast with Icy Nelly.
Okay, we are back. We are talking about algae crew possibilities for Tony's 6.6 gallons, which you probably didn't forget in, like, the 30 seconds that we had our break. But, you know, just in case.
So what's our next species on the list?
Otocinclus.
Oh, yes. Also called Otto's or Otocats or Otocats, whatever. These are lovely little fish. I like them. They're rather appealing. They stay very small. That's the first pro. So, you know, a 6.6 gallon tank, if you're thinking about size, they'll never outgrow it per se, but we'll get to that in the cons. But they do stay small. They're also good at lots of different kinds of algae, and they're especially gentle at getting them off the plants.
So that's good.
They'll nibble algae off of plants in a good way. So among fish, they're one of the best for that. The cons, they're initially not very hardy at all. Which some people speculate.
Established in your tank?
Yeah, once you get a shipment into a pet store of Otto's, it's not uncommon for them to have a very high mortality rate.
Like how high?
Well, just I couldn't give you any exact statistics, but
pretty high.
Pretty high. Let's. Yeah. Many people speculate that the shipping is either very stressful for them, or the collection methods used are very stressful for them. But whatever it is,
are they all mostly wild caught?
Yeah. There are records of them being spawned, but it's not. Most of them don't come from, you know, home spawning. Most of them are still wild collected.
Have people just not really figured out their methods yet, or is it just a pain in the butt?
Well, from what I understand, they'll spawn in small quantities, but they're difficult in captivity. As far as we know, as far as I know, you'll put a half a dozen Otocinclus in a tank, and then a few months later you realize you have 8 instead of 6.
Oh,
you know, that
so
kind of thing has happened. But it's not like you can put 6 in a tank and realize suddenly you have 250, which,
right.
You know, for commercial aquaculture, you need to be able to produce a large number of them. So it may be possible to do it, but I don't think it's been figured out yet.
Well, there is a great niche in the market for somebody to figure that out.
If they can figure out how to produce a lot of them. Yeah, it could be.
Somebody do a thesis on it.
The other thing, though, is once you do get them, if you do get some and they survive the first 10 days or so, they usually do really well for a long time. I've had that happen many times when I bought, you know, buy 3 of them, and one of them dies within 24 hours, and I usually take it back to the store and get a new one, you know. And then that other one still has its, like, a half-life kind of thing. You're wondering if that's going to die, but if it gets past the 10 days, then it's fine, and then they'll live for years. And they do fine. As long as you keep them, you know, healthy. One thing is they really do need more space than a 6.6 gallon.
Even though they stay small?
Even though they stay small. That's my opinion, and I think other people would agree with me. I've kept them in fairly small tanks, but they always seem to do better in 10 plus, and I would say, you know, 20 or more is better. And they need buddies. It's better to keep them with other Otto's. Yeah. Keep, you know, 6, 8, 10 together.
Oh, wow.
And that's great. They'll stay together a lot of the time, hang out. They're very social with each other, more so than, like, bristlenose placos, where the males are territorial. Mm-hmm. Otto's will kind of hang out together. And they're more interesting when they're together than they are when they're alone, too, because they, you know, they interact. And so they really need a fair amount of space. They need buddies. As far as tank conditions go, they do like rather soft acid water. They can adapt to some extent, but that's their preference. And they do like fairly warm water, usually. And, well, I would say probably high 70s to low 80s, somewhere in there. I'm sure people have kept them at other temperatures successfully, but that seems to be the consensus, somewhere in there. And they also need supplemental food, just like Bristlenoses.
The same kind?
Same sorts of things, yeah. They'll eat things like zucchini and peas and stuff like that. Most algae crews, and I won't say all the time, but if you have a 250-gallon planted tank and it's got a lot of light in it and grows a lot of algae, you may have enough food in there for them, but in general, you need to supplement their food.
Okay, let's move on to our next contestant.
Okay, which is?
A mono shrimp.
Mono shrimp. Okay. A mono shrimp are, in terms of pros, they are good algae munchers, including hair algae. They're pretty general purpose. They'll eat lots of different types of algae. They stay fairly small, 2 inches or so, maybe a little over that, but they're large enough that you can keep them with a number of different small killies without worrying about the killies eating them. I mean, some killies probably would, but if the killies aren't particularly aggressive, you'd probably be okay. And they're interesting. They're not fish, but they're an interesting invert that can be good, and I've kept them with a number of different types of fish with, some success. One thing, to step into cons, they won't breed very well in aquaria because their larvae need to go through various salinities. Their larvae grow up part of the time, the early part of their life cycle, in the ocean, and they kind of travel back upstream. And so it can be done in captivity, but not unless you have a dedicated breeding situation where you're changing salinities and so on, or moving them.
Complicated.
So they won't just breed in a tank.
Like a lot of other shrimp.
With one, in a freshwater tank. They can't. They will lay eggs. They'll produce eggs, and you'll see them carrying eggs, the females. If you have, several together, males and females, you see them carrying eggs, so they'll be buried, but you won't get any shrimp out of it. They can and will eat fish eggs, so if you're looking into breeding the killies, I don't think you'd want to put one in there.
Probably wouldn't be breeding in a 6-gallon tank, though.
Killies. Oh, yeah, killies.
How
a lot of killies. Well, there are different varieties of killies, different sizes, and I can't remember exactly which species that Tony was going for, but the kind he's going for will definitely breed in a tank that big, if other conditions being suitable. Yeah, there are a lot of killies that will breed in a gallon.
Wow.
Yeah, a lot of the annual killies, you just put them in a gallon jar with some peat at the bottom, and you're good to go. So, yeah. The Amano shrimp can and will eat soft mosses. They love Java moss. They'll eat Christmas moss. They'll go after those things. So if you're looking at keeping a tank with a lot of happy Java moss in it, then you probably don't want a lot of happy Amano shrimp because they don't go very well together. They can sometimes be aggressive to fish and or other shrimp. It kind of depends on a lot of factors, including how much food they're getting and things like that. Can be an issue.
What do they do that's aggressive to the fish?
Well, they can go after a fish that's, say, sleeping. Great. Take a pot shot at the fins.
Smaller fish.
Things like that. Smaller fish, yeah.
Interesting.
And in terms of tank conditions, those are just a few pros and cons that I can think of. The tank conditions are pretty adaptable. As long as, in terms of ammonia and nitrites and stuff, you don't have any. No measurable ammonia or nitrites. Which is one good reason to have them in a planted tank. Another good reason is because they're good at eating algae. And they like hiding places. When they molt, they need a place to hide where fish can't get to them because fish will slurp up a recently molted shrimp, even fish that would normally not bother them. So those are a few things to think about there. Any tank mates that can eat them probably will. And that said, with some care, I have been able to keep them with fairly large goldfish that would be capable of swallowing them, but they lived their natural lifespan
of
several years which is amazing that they'd even live that long, but like maybe 2.5 years or something in a tank with big goldfish because there are plenty of plants and places for them to hide. And a tank in the low 70s would be great. They'd do fine in that. And they'd do fine a little warmer too. Okay?
How much warmer?
Well, I don't know exactly.
You mean you don't have an exact degree for me?
No, I don't.
Like with a decimal point and everything?
No, I don't.
Okay.
But, you get close to 86 and you're really, really reducing the oxygen, and that's a bad thing. And most things we keep in aquaria don't usually like getting close to that high with some, you know, notable exceptions. But shrimp in general seem to do better in somewhat cooler water than that. So low 70s is great for most shrimp.
So our next one, olive nerites.
Yeah.
Tell us the pros of olive nerites.
Okay. Well, olive nerites, they eat a lot of algae. They're really, really good at that.
That's a good thing.
Yeah, in terms of hair algae, I'm not sure what to say with that. I'm not... In what I can recall, I've kept olive nerites in several systems. They've always done a really good job at eating algae, but I can't really say with hair algae because I don't think I've ever put them in a system with hair algae. So... might be worth the experiment because they're really good at eating a lot of different types of algae. Diatomaceous algae, they're good at that. Filmy algae, grows in the glass, they're good at that. So it might be worth a try.
Diatomaceous algae.
Well, I guess, well, diatoms, not exactly the same thing as algae, I guess, but they're little structures. They build little structures on the glass, and they often end up being visible as little spots of algae on the glass.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So, yeah, so they'll eat those kinds of things. Diatoms are actually, you know, diatomaceous earth.
Mm-hmm.
They have those little skeletons they construct of silica. Yeah, that's... some of them do that and are free-floating, and others attach themselves to glass and things like that in aquaria.
Interesting.
So, anyway... they will not breed in aquaria, which can be a pro. You know, lots of snails will breed like crazy in aquaria, and you have 750 of them before you know what to do with them.
And then you have a snail problem instead of an algae problem.
Right. And they will not breed. They will lay eggs. Many of them will lay eggs, but the eggs won't hatch in fresh water, similar to the situation with the mono shrimp. So you don't have to worry about that. You'll get little sesame seed eggs. They look like sesame seeds sprinkled on things, usually driftwood and occasionally plants in the substrate, and once in a while the glass, although that's not as common. But
seems like usually other things in the tank eat them, though, so it doesn't stay messy looking.
Right, some of the other creatures will eat them. I've heard that quarry cats will eat them and things like that. I haven't kept them in very many systems with quarry cats, maybe one or two. But anyway, there are a couple of things there. In terms of cons, they do prefer hard water, which may not be a con, but if you don't have hard water, then it is a con.
For us, it would be good.
Yeah, and the shells get pitted if you keep them in water that's not very hard. They need the minerals, the calcium, the magnesium, and so on.
I guess that makes sense if you have to make your own shell.
Right, and if they don't get it, the shell will start getting white and dissolving slowly, and they can often survive for a long time like that.
Can't be happy, though.
It looks kind of ugly, and it can't be that fun for them, I imagine.
Your bones melt away.
And so the con is they won't breed. If you want them to breed, they won't breed in a freshwater system. You have to put the eggs into brackish water and so on. I've never actually successfully bred them.
Haven't they hatched before?
Well, I have had them hatch, yes, but I've never had them metamorphose into the snail form that we expect. The little mobile larvae, I've had them appear, but...
they don't get any further.
That's as
than
far
that.
As that. And there's even some debate that there are some species that will live in fresh water if they're given the right circumstances too. But you know, I haven't really gotten into that so much. Anyway, they're pretty cool. Their tank conditions, like we said, they need harder water, their shells will degrade. They do tend to like lower temperatures, they can tolerate warmer ones, but low 70s would be really good. So that would be a really nice option, although hair algae specifically, I'm not sure what they would do.
Okay, let's go on to our next one. Neocaridina shrimp.
Mm-hmm.
Did I say that even approximately correctly?
That sounds good enough for me. Okay, and this is the group that has given us red cherry shrimp.
But
there are also many, many other color varieties to that particular species, and so I don't really want to call them just red cherry shrimp because there are so many. You know, they have blue ones, and they have red and white ones, and they have white ones, and tangerine ones, and yellow ones that are all the same species, or just different morphs, color morphs of the same species. So, there you go. That group, the Neocaridina group, they're all good algae munchers,
mm-hmm.
and they'll eat most types of algae. There's not really a kind of algae that I can think of that they won't eat, although some they'll eat more than others. And they might not eat hair algae quite as much as the Amano shrimp will, but they'll eat it if they're hungry. And if you have a tank that has enough shrimp in it and not really any fish, they can pretty much take down almost any algae. They will breed as long as they are happy and they, you know, feel fairly secure and they're healthy. They will breed like crazy. You can fill a tank with them. You just get a dozen or so.
It's got plenty of algae crew.
Yep. And they stay fairly small. They only get about an inch long. I've had a few get a little bit bigger, but not much. And they're not very aggressive. I've even had, in terms of like attacking fry or attacking even eggs, for example, I bred a white-clad mountain minnows in a tank that had, you know, maybe 20 of these shrimp in there. Mm-hmm. And the white-clad mountain minnows produced a whole big crop of fry with the shrimp right in there. They could have eaten the eggs, and they may indeed have eaten some of them. But they didn't eat enough to cause a big problem because I got a big crop of white-clad mountain minnows anyway. Mm-hmm. And they didn't seem to bother the fry at all. So not very aggressive. Their cons, they're just not as happy with fish. As Juliet in France would attest.
Right.
And I will agree.
A lot on here.
Yes, I agree. They just don't do as well if there are fish in the tank. They can survive and even breed, but they just don't do as well. And at least some of them will be picked off by the fish, whether molting adults or young shrimp or whatever. Even the most innocuous fish will pick off some of them. The tank conditions, they do, like other shrimp, they really require a tank that doesn't have ammonia or nitrites in any measurable degree, and the nitrate should be low. Planted tanks are best. Gentle tank mates also best, and low temperatures are good. They're adaptable, but low temperatures are good.
Okay, next we're going to talk about Java moss.
Now, Java moss might not sound like an algae crew, but it is really
algae
in
carpet?
A way. Well, because it's not an algae, but I mean,
no.
You know, but. It can really help outcompete algae if it's done correctly, you know. And I would just say that if you have a big bunch of healthy growing Java moss and it's got a large amount of biomass in comparison to the tank, it can help prevent algae just by using up a lot of the nutrients that the algae would use.
Just outcompetes it.
Yeah. Now, if you put it in a tank with an existing hair algae issue and the hair algae is going nuts and you drop a few strands of Java moss in there, it could suffer and even be overtaken. It might be covered up by the algae and the algae might win.
So you'd need to put in a large-ish amount.
Yeah, and it would be best to put it in the beginning before the algae has a chance to gain a foothold. But if you were to do that, it could do really well. Like, for example, the betta tank upstairs. I put a pretty big chunk of Java moss in there at the beginning. Before the babies were even in there, when we just put the parents in there. And that has been growing pretty well, and there's hardly any algae at all in that tank. And there's been plenty of time for it to grow. But because that's growing in there, and we're keeping up with water changes and so on, that helps. And so there's very little algae growing in there. And especially if you supplement carbon, like with CO2 injection or something, that will help. Because moss really responds well to that. But it doesn't need it and can often do really well even without it. And it's so adaptable. Mm-hmm. It survives in so many different tank conditions. I mean, people make jokes about how it survives in such great situations. Many mosses, including most Java mosses, prefer cooler water and will grow faster in cooler water, but they'll adapt to almost anything. Like the strain I have, I know Tony has this strain, too, is it will do fine at 80 and grow just fine, like it is in our betta tank at 80 degrees.
Oh, yeah, I guess it is.
It's growing pretty well. Some will slow down or even almost stop at that temperature, but other strains will do fine. Anyway, that can be in the right conditions, especially if it's a preemptive strike against the algae, as it were. Can often be a good way to stave off algae. And what's our final one? I guess that's not really an algae crew, but it's something that helps, you know, combat algae, so I put it there.
That works. So is this one. This is a Flourish Excel.
Okay. Well, I should give the disclaimer. They didn't pay me any money to say that. They didn't even ask me to say it or anything. I'm saying it because...
I'm sure they don't even know.
No, I'm sure they don't. But now this Flourish Excel is a carbon supplement, and it's not sold for algae control. It is sold instead as a carbon supplement for aquaria by Seachem. And I do like several Seachem products. One of my favorites in terms of plant additives for aquaria. But this is an interesting thing. It's not sold for algae control, but it can help control algae in a couple of different ways. First, it can give plants an edge in competing for nutrients, because you give them some supplemental carbon and they'll grow more quickly, and you know that as long as they have enough of everything else, so the other things aren't limiting factors. They have enough iron, they have enough light, and so on. Adding carbon can help them grow. But it also seems to directly damage a lot of different types of algae. And the interesting thing is, well, I'm not sure how it works, but Seachem themselves, like I said, they don't market it with that feature in mind, but they acknowledge that a lot of people write in and tell them, oh, I just tried this and my algae disappeared. And sometimes people will actually get it in an eyedropper and jet it at particular strands of algae they're trying to destroy, and it seems to help.
I wonder what it does.
It's strange. It is, the chemical, I guess, is also used as an industrial disinfectant. But that's an interesting thing. So you have to be careful using it. You can't overdose it or anything. And so I'm not necessarily endorsing that you should, you know, jet it right at strands of algae. And you do need to make sure you're careful with the instructions for using it. But you can look up using Seachem Flourish Excel as algae control, and you'll get some good hits online, and that could be helpful. But I've noticed some things, like at work, I have a 5.5 gallon aquarium, fairly heavily planted. It gets dosed with Excel every day, just a teeny bit. It's like half a milliliter or something. And I've gotten olive nerite and several wild type cherry shrimp. They're sometimes called wild cherries, depending on who you're talking to. And it's got a bunch of Java moss and some Java fern and Anubias growing in there. Algae is extremely scarce in that tank. And I attribute that partly to, you know, a fairly low bio load. And it's also got a betta in there. And sometimes frogs. And there's hardly any algae in that tank. And I think part of it is because of the Seachem Flourish Excel. So, you know, you might want to give that a try. Could be an interesting way to do it. And the last one I want to mention is Juliet in France has mentioned that Endler's live bears are great at hair algae. She said they'll just peck at it until it's gone.
That's cool.
And they'll do it fast. Much better than any other fish she's ever tried. I haven't kept Endler's live bears, but it might be worth a look, because it seems to be working for Juliet. And you may have a different species of algae than she does, but hey, could be worth a try. And finally, Tony wanted to know about Mick's mini marine aquarium that was mentioned in episode 125. He was wondering how many gallons it was. Well, this is the cool thing, okay? I went on and went back into our archives to check how many gallons it was. And Mick mentioned that it was in liters, and so I did the conversion. It was about 7.9 gallons, so around 8 gallons. But this is the fun thing. With the displacement from the live rock and sand, 6.6 gallons. So the same as Tony's tank in terms of effective water volume. Sorry. And of course, Tony probably has some displacement anyway, but I thought that was kind of a cool coincidence. Both 6.6 gallons. So that is about it for this week, ladies and gentlemen. We look forward to hearing from all you Aquariumaxers out there.
May the fish
be with you.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Aquariumax Audio Show. For additional episodes, please visit aquariumax.com.
For comments and or questions that may be featured on an upcoming podcast, leave a message at 801-477-0629 or email us at info@aquariumax.com.